sucked, but it's not been, you know, the end of my life.
Right.
I'm not having a sensible response. I'm having an anxiety response about it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm more concerned just at, like, what the future looks like, period. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Dude, I'm going to be honest. I feel like at the end of this, nothing will change, and we'll still be in this, like, weird, surreal period where things happen and then it just kind of goes away and it plods on, you know?
Yeah, man, that's exactly what's gonna happen. Well, I think so.
You think so?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's like, history is starting, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like I've gotten multiple messages from people being like, history's back, bro, like, history's starting again.
How pathetic, like, really, when you really get down to it, the fact that, like, you know, it's, oh my, like, it's the coronavirus and then the incredibly maybe necessary but horrible state intervention into society that people are, that's what makes history back on the table again.
Yeah.
It could be a pivotal moment in, like, global relations. Like, you know, it's like that old, it's in Watchmen, I think, right? Like, the idea that, like, an existential threat can unite the globe.
It's fucking Alan Moore is doing this. He's the one that caused it.
Yeah, Alan Moore created this. But, like, I think there's something to that. And I think, you know, obviously we just started talking, but obviously that ties into the book we read. But
yeah, but, but history has been happening. You know, like, even the quote-unquote end of history is, I mean, it wasn't, you know, like, things still happened.
Well, I don't think that's what he meant.
No, he meant that liberal democracy, you know, reigns supreme, right? There is no, we've reached the final form of human civilization and we're just going to manage it as it exists. But,
well, even if everybody thinks that there's going to be some homeostasis at some point, but I don't agree with that. Like, democracy, communism, whatever it is that takes over, there's not just going to stay that way forever. It's not the way humans are.
I think it was prescient, like, it, you know what I mean, like, it accurately just kind of described what happened in the 90s and the aughts, you know what I mean, like, the last few decades, like, have felt like a post-political era, you know, like, it has been like consensus neoliberalism in the West, but definitely not in the rest of the world.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, like, in terms of, like, there is definitely a change, right, in the way states and people are approaching these new problems. And I think the coronavirus is exacerbating things that are already happening. But I think when people are saying history is back on the table, they're trying to imply that, like, there's, you know, some sort of unlimited possibilities for the future where really, you know, we're all just kind of like, everybody is moving in directions that are opened up to them by, like, what is necessary right now. I'm not convinced that there's, like, that the world's going to become more political. Actually, I really think it's going to be the opposite of that. Especially with all of these emergency measures that are being put in, it's only going to lead to a greater expansion of the state. And I think we're going to be living with those consequences for a long time.
Maybe it's a good thing we're not getting a UBI.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how that's supposed to work, right?
We're getting a credit, but that's not new.
Is it a credit? Is that what that is?
No, you're right. It's not a credit. It's a one-time payment.
I thought it was just a straight-up check. Like, they're going to mail us checks.
It's a one-time check, which is, like, the third time in the last 20 years one has gone out. You know, it's like, this isn't, like, a new idea. Like, Bush did it twice. Right? Or was it Bush once and Obama once? I don't remember, but
I think it was Bush once. Did Obama actually send out checks? I don't remember that.
Checks went out in 08, didn't they?
I'm not sure.
It was 08. I don't know if it was Bush or Obama, though.
That's my question, yeah. But, like, I'm under the impression that in 08 they went out, and then in 2001 they definitely went out.
Right.
Which is, I mean, I don't know, it's just so weird thinking about 2001, like, oh, somebody bomb the World Trade Center, here's a check for $50. Like, such a weird response.
Well,
wasn't that in response to the .com bubble, though?
Was it .com bubble? I don't know what it was in response to. I thought .com bubble makes much more sense.
I thought it was 9/11. Like Bush was like, go out and spend because everyone was scared and staying home. Maybe.
Whatever. I don't know. I was. How old was I? Like 10.
Yeah, I was 11. So. Yeah.
But I get frustrated with the, you know, I don't know. I'm a little bit concerned about the like lefty progressive types that are on Facebook right now. Cause I mean, I couldn't imagine a more servile attitude, you know, like it's just that, like they want to have a stay at home order. Right. Like, I don't think there's any real understanding of how awful this is going to be for like so many millions of people because they have to be like forced to quarantine for this long. And any leaning towards optimism about like that this could be over soon and that maybe we can go back to work and, you know, things can return to some kind of normalcy is seen as irresponsible. And, you know, I'm not saying that you should emphatically, you know, be not cautious or something like that, but I just do not understand that, like, why it is a good thing. Like, it might need to happen, but I don't understand why people are touting it as a good thing.
I guess, from my perspective as someone who has to work through this, like, leave the house and work, like, it's like the idea that I could stop everything, go out, is kind of a relief to me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And a stay at home order won't apply to me. But like, I don't want to. I mean, I need.
Dude, it went out today. It happened at like 2 p.m. today. New Hampshire is staying shelter in place.
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Sununu put one out today. It's not shelter in place though. He specifically made a point to say it's stay at home because he said a governor does not have the legal power to issue a shelter in place order. And he's not restricting travel between states, which is a very like New Hampshire way of announcing one, I think.
That is super New Hampshire. Also, I'm pretty sure he does have the very specific legal authority to order that.
I honestly have no idea, but I don't know. He's not a very good governor or smart guy.
Yeah, I don't think he's a very apt politician. We'll forget about him in 5 years.
He's got gusto. He's got like fat guy funnies. So that's about all he's got going for him.
We'll remember him in 20 years when his son is governor.
Right.
I mean, they're like the New Hampshire political dynasty. They've been like mediocre villains for 50 years.
Yeah, because wasn't his dad in Congress and then his brother was a state senator? Like, so they're definitely
the dad governor at one point.
I believe so. Yeah.
The dad was governor too.
Yeah. The whole, it's like them and the Shaheens, just like awful people.
Dude, I learned about the Shaheens in the Stranglehold podcast. They got their start by stumping for Jimmy Carter during his presidential run. It's like, oh man, that's what gets you to power in New Hampshire, is right. Stumping for Jimmy Carter, and then he did nothing.
Hey, well, Jimmy campaigned hard in New Hampshire. My dad always tells a story about the time he met him. He walked into my dad's store while he ran a convenience store, and my dad was in the walk-in, and Jimmy Carter went all the way into the walk-in and introduced himself and was like, I'm Jimmy Carter and I'm your next president. And my dad was like, all right, okay.
That's kind of tight though.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, he left all those hostages, right? Wasn't that the whole thing?
Yeah. What's the story? What's the story on that one, man? I don't know.
No, dude, it's Bush Senior.
No, it was Reagan.
Bush Senior, well, yeah. Like specifically was like Nick Deal. Like it could have happened under Carter, but Bush was like, nah. Just so that when Reagan came into power, it's like, oh my god, the Iranians are so afraid, they immediately let the Americans go. Like, yeah, yeah. That's what happened.
Yeah. No, I was just teasing. Yeah, Jimmy Carter got duped because he is kind of a dupe.
Yeah. I don't really understand Jimmy Carter's political like legacy or anything, so I've never looked into it. But if I'm going to be honest, as a child, I had an obsession with Jimmy Carter.
Jesus Christ.
Weird, okay.
So in fourth grade, I was in – this is stupid. I was in, you know, gifted and talented classes. Did you guys have that?
Yeah, I was not in them, though.
Yeah, I was because I was a loser. I was an asshole. I think they put like the kids who were douchebags in class in those. So for my fourth grade gifted and talented class, I did a project on Jimmy Carter. That was the entire thing. And I had a Jimmy Carter bobblehead and a Jimmy Carter necklace.
Wow. You really were killing it. That was like, was that when you peaked?
It was definitely when I peaked. I was definitely very cool. That was right around the time I got my back brace.
Speaking of which, that reminds me of, like, I would say of all of the petty things that I'm upset about right now, it's that I can't go to the gym. And not only has it been horrible for my anxiety, because that's like how I work that shit out, but like my gains, there's only so long.
I know.
I mean, man. I'm already into day 10 now of not going to the gym. Sucks.
I'm going soft in the belly. I have a 40-pound bag of kitty litter, and I've just been doing single leg deadlifts with it for like 15 reps.
That's awesome.
I'm depressed about it. Zach, my coach did offer me to use his garage gym every once in a while during this, so I might actually be able to deadlift and squat.
You're very lucky, dude. I was like somewhat fantasizing about getting a bunch of exercise equipment. I have like a little basement storage area that I could clear out and maybe put in there, but because of the economic uncertainty, I really just don't want to drop like $1,000, $1,500 on gym equipment. You know what I mean? And yeah. And then, you know, get it all set up. And I do like going to the gym. I would prefer to go to the gym than work out at home. You know, like
I would way rather go to the gym.
I'd like to be able to do both. I'd like to be able to do my squats and deadlifts at home, but I definitely would want to go to the gym for doing like my snatching and clean and jerks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do that. It's like, you know, you have to have so much ceiling. Like, I don't know. I
would. Yeah, to do a snatch. Right.
Yeah, I would just like to do it at the gym and be able to drop the bar and all, you know.
Impress all the people around you.
No, I don't think anyone's impressed when they watch it.
Not when you pass out and then wake up
when
you
like belt off. Absolutely fuck my shit up.
You know, you snatch too hard and then the bros come and they take what they want.
Dude, there are like I am like the bro at my gym. It's not a very bro heavy gym.
Damn, that's a beta ass gym.
It's no, I mean there's like a lot of strong ass dudes, but it's like UNH students who are all like pretty jacked, but they do bodybuilding. And then like old powerlifters in their like 30s and 40s. And then just like normies.
I love those guys, the old power lifters.
They're the nicest. They're just cool. They like compliment your form. They offer to spot you. They offer to videotape your sets. They do. They're the best, dude.
And they can lift so fucking much.
Oh, it's sick. There's a guy who's like kind of like your height, Sam, at my gym.
Okay.
He's the nicest guy ever. He's got a daughter who's like 15. So he must be getting up there. But he regularly is just like repping squats in like around like 315 pounds.
Damn, dude.
Like, and it's just like for a smaller dude, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Who's like clearly in his 40s. It's just like, it's sick. That's like exactly where I want to be when I'm in my 40s. Respect.
Well, I mean more, right? You want to be lifting more, I hope.
Nah, I don't care.
I'm ready. You don't care? I'm down just for like the calisthenics life. I was trying to do a push-up today. Couldn't do it. Straight all the way down the legs. The pain from the back is crazy.
Oh, that sucks, dude.
One of these days, though, man.
I just have a... So it was just that deadlift? It ruptured two discs?
No, it was more like that injured the muscles in my back. And then it was just like some random thing. I was just standing up, but my muscles weren't there to protect my spine anymore. So I was like, if there's nothing surrounding it, it's super fragile.
Yeah, that'll happen. Yeah, the back is like so fucking weird. Like the little movements, like routine movements, will fuck you up so bad.
Yeah, yeah, because my muscles weren't in place to like hold everything steady.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, damn, you get there though. All right, I'm on.
How long is the recovery?
Honestly, I don't know. Like, I'm hoping to get a surgery, but I can't right now because of the virus and everything that's going on, but I would honestly not want to get it and then get the virus because that could kill me, but it would also suck to be coughing nonstop on a pinched nerve. That would be awful, so I don't know. I'm just going to lay low for a while. I'm on steroids. They're probably going to give me a shot. I mean, this is almost month 5 of it, so which isn't uncommon. There's some people that I know at work where it's like, they're like, yeah, this is the event that changed my life. And I was like, oh, shit. Yeah.
God damn, that sucks, dude. I'm sorry. That really sucks.
That's right. I've lost some good weight. I've lost like 15 pounds because not eating anything, so that's good.
All right. Do you guys want to start the book then?
Yeah, we have a voicemail from Chris, but I just don't feel like it's going to work today.
Well, I just want to do the reading group. We can do the Chris voicemails when we're all together. I think that'll be better.
Yeah.
Yeah, then you get the laugh reactions of everybody listening to his corrections.
And I think we could probably pull it off in this environment here, but, you know, it's new and, you know, we want to make sure everything works pretty good. And Chris's voicemails are generally pretty damn good, so we want to make sure that they are framed well.
And honestly, I'm going to want to drop them directly into the Audacity file.
Right.
Let's give it some thought. Sorry I even said anything.
No, you're good, dude. You're good. So I wrote up this, like, beautiful intro. It took me a while to get through, but... especially because we did the whole book this time instead of one half. I'm just going to do sort of an intro to the book. So, all right, everybody. Welcome to the Literal Fiction Book Club, where we read books so you don't have to. My name is Sam Johnson, and joining me today is...
Alex.
And Troy. And,
excellent. You can give us your thoughts, responses, and tirades by leaving a voicemail on our Book Nerds hotline. The number is 1-978-255-3404. We've already kicked things off with the coronavirus here and our struggles with it, so we're going to jump right into the book now. We've been reading The Three Body Problem by Shixun Liu. This book is considered a pioneering work in Chinese science fiction and has popularized the genre internationally. The book has endorsement blobs from Barack Hussein Obama to Can't Finish His Own series, George Real Rad Martin. The novel opens in the middle of the Chinese Cultural Revolution and takes the reader to an alternate version of our present, in which a mysterious epidemic of top scientist suicides has struck fear into governments around the globe. The world is full of colorful characters, the crooked cop Da Shi, the proud and resilient Yi Wenji, and the practical Wang Miao. The central conflict of the novel is discovering what force is thwarting the scientific progress of humanity. The big reveal in the last act is contact with an advanced civilization known as the Tri-Solaris in Alpha Centauri, Earth's closest celestial neighbor. Through the history of China's Red Coast Extraterrestrial Contact Project, Wang Mao's exploration of virtual reality game Three Body, and the international government's conflict with the Earth Trisolarian Organization, we learn that both humanity's and the Trisolarian's main concern is time. The technological advancement of the Trisolarians is far beyond humanity's. However, it will take 450 years for them to reach Earth and conquer it. The development of Trisolarian civilization has progressed in stops and starts, due to the three-body problem, an issue in classical physics where if three or more masses are in mutual gravitational pull, predicting their future motion is impossible. The Trisolarians, as their name implies, have three stars. The unpredictable motion of their star produces either stable eras, where civilization can flourish, or chaotic eras, where their planet becomes difficult to inhabit. They live in deep fear that one day one of their stars will simply destroy their planet, so they commit to colonize elsewhere. Due to Earth's single-star solar system and temperate climate, humanity can make up lost ground. Humanity's scientific progress can advance exponentially quicker than the Trisolarians, and so the Trisolarians fear that by the time they reach Earth, humans' technological capacity will have them beat. So the Trisolarians blast a multi-dimensional supercomputer the size of a proton called a SOFON across space to hinder the scientific progress of humanity by blocking humanity's insights into the nature of matter. The details for how this works and the three-body problem take up several chapters, so you'll just have to take my word for it. The novel ends on a cliffhanger. Will humanity rise to the challenge of outsmarting the Sofons and preparing for battle with the Trisolarians, or will they accept an inevitable doom? Shixun Liu is an accomplished science fiction author. The Three-Body Problem was the first Asian novel to win the Hugo Award for Best Novel. He got his start through a state-funded science fiction magazine called Science Fiction World. After publishing a short story called Mountain, he was encouraged to write a novel, eventually submitting The Three-Body Problem in serialized format to Science Fiction World. Pretty good intro,
I didn't realize this was funded by the CCP.
Yeah, dude. I'm very surprised about that, but let's start there because I would say that was the depiction of the Cultural Revolution was the thing. I mean, it opens, the book opens there, and that that threw me most for the loop because I'm not super familiar with Chinese politics, but I was expecting that the Cultural Revolution would at the very least be a touchy subject, you know, like something that you couldn't really comment on, but it was portrayed pretty gruesomely.
I think it's because they were able to effectively, like, protect the party. Like, weirdly enough, it's not Mao's fault somehow. It's, like, the Gang of Four, which just blows my mind because the people that came afterwards, like Deng Xiaoping, were, like, directly purged during this by Mao. And it was, like, the commitment that they have to just, like, keep the party going is crazy. But it's almost like an aberration. They blame it not on the party. Or at least that's my understanding of it.
Well, I mean, right, but like, wouldn't, I just wonder what the memory of the Cultural Revolution is like, because obviously this got past censors and, you know, was in a magazine sponsored by the CCP. So I'm curious as to what, you know, this is one of the most popular novels in China. So there is, like, the views of the CCP are going to, at the very least, be reflected, or at least the non-offensive views can be put in there. And I'm curious as to why they don't find this offensive at all. Because, I mean, when the novel opens up, we get Yi Wenjing in a crowd watching her father get prosecuted by the Red Guards and then eventually murdered. And, you know, there's a, I guess it seems like in modern China, intellectuals have a much better standing than they did under the Cultural Revolution and the years prior to that. So, but most of the sufferers or all of the sufferers, I should say, in these opening chapters are intellectuals. They had a pretty good, I thought the opening was really strong. They had, you know, sort of three examples of intellectuals. You had Yi Wenjing's father, who is like the principled one, right? The one who fights back and is eventually killed. You have her mother, who is a professor, but capitulates to the Red Guards. And then you have her advisor. I forget her name, but her advisor commits suicide. And so those were kind of like the three paths for the learned at the time. But still, it was quite brutal, and there was no real. It didn't feel like he was mincing words very much.
I got real down when I was first reading this because that day, or the like first half of the book, I looked pretty far into the Cultural Revolution, and it was like, oh man, it just like had Carlyle just smeared all over it, just like the terror and all the awful bits of anarchy. That's like the entirety of what it was, but for 10 years.
Can you give us some like highlights of the gore that you found?
Oh, it's kind of just like, it's almost the opening of this book is like a snapshot of it. Like people would go around and, oh God, what were they called? It was, they would get people and they would berate them just like they did her
father. Struggle sessions?
Struggle sessions, yeah, I couldn't think of the word. And those would go on for like 5-6 hours, and people had these heavy signs hung around their necks, and they would just be beaten with belts and boards and other things, and they were like tortured throughout the streets of the city. And then most of the people weren't actually murdered; most of them just killed themselves. Like they were basically put into struggle sessions day after day after day until they just died, like until they just gave up the will to live, which is terrifying. And
I guess that's a way to save bullets, right?
Yeah. And then, but just like the descent into anarchy of these Red Guards then fighting each other, I think like part of the reason it got past the censor is they show that it was almost like useful cadres getting out of control. Because like she tracks down the three people that kill her father and they don't care. They're like, yeah, so what? I lost my arm or I got sent out to the countryside.
Nobody remembers us.
About us. But it was almost like you just blame the whole thing on youth. It was like, oh, they just got a little out of control. Not like they almost completely destroyed the country and killed 20 million people, but, you know, whatever. Just
yeah, I thought I thought that the policy of sending them out to the country was actually pretty smart on a political level, you know? Like that's the perfect little boomerang to do, right? So you're like, okay, all this revolutionary fervor, you know, you have this essentially a peasant revolution is the communist revolution in China, and then you just take them and you go, okay, well, you need to go out, you know, go out with the people, right, the peasants, and you know, build up Greater China or wherever, and it dissipates all of the pent up, you know, urban angst and hormones of these children, and then it dissipates, which I thought was quite clever on their part.
Take out the youthful rage on trees.
Right, right.
I think it almost like views the cadres or whatever they are, like it treats them like they're absurd. Like it doesn't really treat them seriously, I don't think. I mean, it takes them seriously in like that in their views. You know, obviously their consequences are serious. And I thought like a good example of that was it when it reads off, or just like the political character of the time, like the message that they send to the aliens after they find out that she sent a message.
I like that a lot. Yeah,
I laughed out loud at that page because, also, you know, having been around people on the left, like it really was like, oh yeah, that's real. When it's like this message was sent out by a country that represents revolutionary justice on Earth.
Oh God, yeah, I could totally imagine a few Facebook posters we know who would. That's the message they would send out. You know.
Yeah, and it's like, don't believe the other message. They're imperialist scum. That was a really good part.
Yeah, I thought that was really funny, and I thought it was also telling in terms of like the way in which he was treating like these groups. Like, I think if this was like a dark, heavy hand, and it's dark, but like if this was like a heavy handed political condemnation of like their goals, I don't think the CCP would like it. But in treating it kind of like a juvenile insanity or whatever, it. I don't know. It seems to kind of shift the responsibility from the party itself or the state itself.
I think the state and the party is never implicated. It's like only the youth that are implicated in the book.
Right. Yeah, and I think too that's a good point about how, you know, the leaders after the Cultural Revolution were exiled CCP members. So they probably have a, you know, that the inheritors of post-Cultural Revolution China probably don't have a favorable view of the Cultural Revolution. They see it as like a ultra-left deviation or something like that.
Yeah, Deng's father was... I don't think his father was killed in this, but Deng's father was killed in one of the purges from Mao. And it's just like, I don't know. It just blows my mind that they're still loyal to the party after all of it.
Well, I mean, it was the only game in town, right?
That's true. It's still the only game in town.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like the structure of their state. You know, it's not a party like we think of parties in the United States.
Yeah. No, that's true.
So, I mean, you know, we're reading, we bring this up every single time, you know, kind of critiquing or engaging with the writing abilities of the authors we engage with. And so I kind of wanted to open up the discussion to, you know, what do we think of Xu Jianlu's prose? I found myself wanting to be forgiving because this is a translation, and I'm sure that some of the more clunky analogies aren't nearly as clunky in Chinese. But there's just like certain parts of this book that are, I can't chalk that up to. Like most of the characters are pretty flat, you know, even like a character that I like Da Xi.
I love Da Xi. He's my favorite character.
He's fucking cool. He's cool as shit, but he's like not a real person, you know, and it's very clear.
He's like a trope. He's a cliche. He's like the gruff detective. You know what I mean? Like the fact that
right.
the best character in the book is like, ugh. And he is the best character in the book. Not disagreeing by any means. He was amusing and everything. But like, it was like he was plucked out of a noir movie, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but he's Chinese, and that's what makes it fun, is that it's like a noir detective, but he's eating tripe.
He's eating bat.
Oh, God. Yeah, yeah. Where's the coronavirus in your fucking story, Xu Jianlu?
Ugh,
dude, for real though, Da Xi eats tripe like 3 times in the book, and every time I'm like, oh my God, it's so gross.
It's like a normal food. It blows my mind. We are so like those textures of like Westerners just like despise, but people in like the whatever China is, China just aren't grossed out by like the gummy kind of
in the. You mean people in the barbarian nations?
Yeah, yeah, the barbaric nation of China.
I was listening to a thing on the radio. They actually have, or they value texture in food the same way, almost as much as taste. So, like, if there's different tastes in, like, something's hot versus cold versus just right, that's also like, oh, well, it's gummy versus it's crumbly. Like, they have many more textures to their food than we do. And yeah. I don't know that I'm really missing it. Like, I'm fine with the 4 or 5 that we have. I don't need the other 6. I don't need my food to be made into, like, gummy balls.
For real. I was actually reading online some, maybe it was a Reddit thread. It was basically like, Chinese people, what American foods are you like, this is fucking disgusting? Because I was just like thinking about that. Obviously, there's been a lot of conversation about what Chinese people eat lately. And they were talking about like mac and cheese. Like that to them is like revolting. Like this like slimy mixture of like cow juice. Like,
dude, mac and cheese is so good though.
I know. I eat mac and cheese almost every single day. It's part of my bulking. But like it kind of makes sense if you start to think about it, and it's like a cool exercise of, you know, generic cultural sensitivity or whatever, to think about what's fucked up to other cultures that we take for granted.
Right, but I mean, when you come from the greatest civilization, i.e. Western civilization, like mac and cheese, you know, I mean, I guess that's how you decide, you know, who's in and who's out, you know, who's cultured and who's not, right? Yeah, whether you like mac and cheese.
When you put it that way.
You know, if you can't get down with, you know, Auntie Anne's, you know, white sauce soft shells, then ew. I guess.
Annie's, what? Dude. Annie's white cheddar all the way.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what I actually meant. But I put quite a bit of whiskey in my drink today.
Did you just call Annie's mac and cheese Auntie
Anne's?
Yeah, sure did.
Aren't they the pretzel place?
Yeah, Auntie Anne's is the pretzel place.
Oh my god, imagine a pretzel filled with mac and cheese. Ooh. From Auntie Anne's.
That would be good.
Oh my god, no, it wouldn't. That's revolting.
I would eat the shit out of that. I don't think a Chinese person would like it, but I fucking would.
I would have to be super inebriated to eat something like that.
Dude, the thing is like, I've been thinking about, like, I don't know about you guys, but during this quarantine phase, I've just been thinking about the restaurants I'm going to go to when this is over. Like, and also, like, the friends I'm going to see and, like, you know, all that kind of stuff, too. But, like, I really want fucking Chinese dumplings, like, very bad. Like,
dude, before we got quarantined, I wanted to come over to the apartment and get Chen's Garden. Like, I want their Peking dumplings so bad.
Yeah. I mean, I got to give it to them, man. They have some of the best food in the entire world.
They know how to fry dough, those little fuckers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're gonna ball out. Whenever this coronavirus thing is over, we're gonna have a good ass time. Assuming we have any money and, you know, the world didn't dissolve into nothing, we're gonna have a good ass time.
We need to drink whatever that Chinese what's that liquor called? It's like their version of vodka. Oh god, what is it? Anyway, we just need to get like a massive jug of that and take shots. It's gonna be good stuff.
I'm down.
Fuck yeah.
Hold on, it's gonna kill me. I have to look this up.
We can all search for or we can all share a toilet together, you know, puking into it.
Baijiu, that's what it is. They even drink that in the book too. They drink Baijiu in the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Dashi. Dashi drinks it and he gives it to a couple of other characters. They like drink it when they're trying to steal their resolve, or he gives it to him when he's like, "Are you sure you want to know what this is?" Yeah.
I do like that. I was watching a movie, what was it called? The Third Man today. I don't know if you've seen that.
Oh, great movie. I love that movie.
Yeah, it's just like the perfect movie to watch while you're quarantined. But but I love how like he's about to get bad news. The army guys like get him a double whiskey. Like they just got bottles of whiskey on hand at all times in case someone hears some bad news. I would like to bring that back.
I'm down.
Man, it's too bad it's been so long since we finished this book. Because when we first finished it, I was, like, filled with anger about how much I hated it. And now I'm like, who? Who's this character?
I am not going to lie. I have trouble with some of the names because it's been a couple weeks. Like, I remember Dashi just because Dashi's my favorite character. And then,
let me help you Bebs along, all right?
You know, the funniest thing is I don't remember the like, main character. He's so vanilla. I don't even
Wang Rao. He's just our he's the character that you're supposed to insert yourself into.
Yeah, terrible. Because he has no personality.
Awful.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that, like, threw me off for the whole, like, threw me off from Zhi Jianlu being, like, anywhere near even, like, an average writer was that scene where Wang was burned at the stake while he was in the three-body game, and he was yelling about how he can just log on with a new Mac address. Do you guys remember that scene?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, it was...
Like, Jesus Christ, like, pick anything else to say while you're being burned alive, please.
Yeah, I mean, I it's like, I really liked the first half of the book, and then once it got into the parts with during the three-body game, I was just like, this is just... I can't believe I have to fucking read this. I don't know.
I was with it up until they went to Tri Solaris. Like, once they tried to just make, like, that civilization seem similar to humanity, and it was, like, comparing humans not wanting aliens to destroy it, but how it's going to alter humanity, like, forever, and then it shows the same thing in their planet, but it's like, I don't want to, like, know about their society. It's supposed to be, like, a mystery and almost horror. And the unknown, yeah. Like, just leave it that way.
And dude, and if I want to learn about their society in a book that's marketed as a hard sci-fi book, I would hope that it's like an interesting alien civilization that's novel and, like, you know what I mean? But instead it's like they're just kind of like humans, but on a different plane. It's so bad.
But they can dehydrate. That's their thing.
So if this book was marketed as a fantasy novel, I wouldn't have been as annoyed, honestly.
It's definitely not hard sci-fi. I don't know what to call it. It's not space opera. It's not hard sci-fi. It's, I don't know, just...
It's funny because it starts off that way. And I think the idea of, like, first contact with an alien species is, like, in a modern perspective, is such a cool topic.
Yeah.
That it's like, how can you fuck that up?
Oh, I was super with it at the beginning when it's just like... Dang. There's three scientists that kill themselves in a row. It's like, oh, damn, like, the stakes are high. And then all it is the number that's counting down. Is like, that's such a cool and so simple. Like, that's the only thing that you see from the alien civilization is they have a timer of when they're going to arrive. Like, if it had just left it that simple, I was very hooked at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of, you know, I was messaging you guys before, like, Ender's Game did such a better job at, like, an alien civilization. That was another sci-fi novel, and it kept everything, like, to the point where, like, the big pivotal point in that book was the ability for the main character Ender to interact with the alien civilization, to relate to it in some way. Whereas, like, in this book, you know, it just straight in, like, it shoehorns in all of human development into Trisolarian culture, right? Like, they have these different physical characteristics, like, you know, the ability to dehydrate and, like, the way their bodies are formed. But they go through, I mean, he literally describes it as, like, the progression of civilization is the exact same, right?
Yeah.
You're going through these different ages, right, which are deterministic, right? Because in Trisolarian culture, all of society is destroyed every once in a while and they start over again. And so it's like Sisyphus, you know, pushing the boulder up the hill and then being sent back down.
It definitely doesn't work for the checkpoints. Like, there's of other sci-fi I've read, it's kind of common tropes of you measure it of where they're at. Like, all right, they're in pre-industrial, they're industrial, now they're nuclear, now they're at the information age. But you're right, that makes no sense if their society is constantly destroyed.
Yeah, and it's just like, why, you know, why do they, like, it is so clearly a state versus another state. Like, that's what the relationship is between Trisolaris and Earth. It is not two alien civilizations, right, with two different sets of, like, you know, the infinite possibilities of biological development. It's just, it's China versus the U.S., you know, I guess, right? Like, is the analogy. And I thought that was just lazy. I mean, even to the point where when we find out about the guy, the Trisolarian who received the message from Yue Wenjing, he describes a labor market. He says how he's not going to have a job.
Yeah. Which is like, fuck, for someone who's coming from China, like, well, I guess maybe I'm giving too much credit to the CCP, but like, Jesus Christ.
But it's just like, not even a sense of like, you know, either higher in the sense of like a communist utopia or lower in the sense of slavery, right? Like there's no dynamism to it. It's just like, okay, it's normal bourgeois capitalist society, but they can dehydrate and they have this really hard physics problem to solve, you know, like, okay.
I wish they had just left their society out. I remember, Alex, you were also upset at the bending the proton in 9 dimensions.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean,
go off, King. Tell us what you think about it.
I mean, it's just stupid. I don't know. It's just like, at least it's inventive, I guess. You know what I mean? Him inventing this thing that couldn't possibly happen. Like, at least it's creative compared to his alien species.
I thought that piece was okay. Okay, like it's definitely not hard sci-fi because it's nowhere near anything that we could hope to recreate, but if we're talking about a civilization that does have faster than light travel and potentially is like at level 2 where they can harness the level of their entire star, like they could probably do some pretty crazy stuff if they're at that level.
Well, you know, so I think the reason this book is called Hard Sci-Fi is because they don't have faster than light travel.
Oh, that's right. True. That's right. Yeah,
I think that's probably why it's classified as hard sci-fi. It's like just for that specific reason. Because I don't know. They don't believe it's possible to travel faster than light. And it probably isn't possible.
And then even if they were like bending the proton a million different ways, cool. But that they make a supercomputer on it, that just seems so human. Like of all the things that they could have done, they built like a processor on a proton, and then they like send the proton and it magically knows how to infiltrate all the different reactors in CERN and around the world. It's just like, yeah, I felt like it almost dived into fantasy at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say the coolest part of the entire book is when they make the circuits out of human beings. I thought that was actually one of the most creative moments of the book. I liked that. I was like, oh, cool. Cool idea.
I take a different opinion. I actually liked the scenes where it was the game, because even though it's like modeled on humanity, the game is specifically supposed to be like that, where it's supposed to be something where the user feels comfortable with it, which is why everybody's like Confucius and Copernicus and Galileo. It's like supposed to be things that humans would recognize.
Well, humans made the game,
right? Yeah, as the Canadian nihilist.
Yeah.
Who he's also a good character. He's my favorite.
Let's get into the eco-fascism in this book.
Yeah, so like Extinction Rebellion,
clearly represented as the ETO. Like the, you know, like Yi Wenjing, and then you know, whatever Bill Withers. I don't even know what the fuck the guy's name was. but yeah, I know Bill Withers is a soul singer. But yeah, it's just like, you know, the character of the Trisolarian civilization and then the rebellion groups on Earth is like it's so incredibly reactionary, right? Like on one level they're desiring for like the gods of the universe to hand over all this like beneficent technology or whatever to humanity, but really their motivation is just like a pure hatred for their fellow man, right? Because of all the horrible things that people do. Mm. As if, like, Trisolarian civilization, I mean, it is essentially run as, like, kind of a stoic version of Spartan society, right? Like, if you don't conform to the moral imperatives of Trisolarian civilization, you are evaporated, right? Like, that's the way they deal with things. It's like survival of the most stoic or something like that. I just feel like the ETO did not have enough oomph to it, you know. It was like it was just like this other kind of ideology that I feel like could have, like, the factions in the ETO could have been expounded on better and had a little bit more meat to it, rather than, you know, this sort of summary description of the different groups and then kind of whatever.
Yeah, I feel like it could have been just more of the same where they are describing the different groups, but just like with the alien civilization, just like less is more. We don't need to know the details about all of them. Because when they first started introducing it, I was like, ooh, man, this is kind of eerie. It's like these people that support the aliens and they've already infiltrated all levels of society all over the world. Like, this is super creepy. And then Yay Wen Ji comes in like, let me just explain everything as exposition. I was like, oh, okay.
No, it's just a lazy move. Just to have her like explain it in front of everyone to Wang. But like,
well, to the interrogator.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. But she does in the begin. She also explains a lot in front of everyone to Wang when he goes to the meeting, right?
Right. Yeah. But the big reveal is at the interrogator when she explains the like motivations and as far as the ETO is concerned.
Right. Okay. Yeah, you're right.
But yeah, there's like four or five very egregious examples of just like vomiting exposition all over the place, which again, I don't know if that's a cultural thing. Like maybe that's not considered like a literary taboo in Chinese. I honestly don't know.
I mean, I just think it's lame. You know, it's like what you know, you could show all of that information more like better than you could tell it. Yeah. I think that like the vomit exposition works okay. Like it plods along when it's about science, right? So like, but even so, right? Like I got a lot more out of the concept of the three body problem by the video game, which is a way of demonstrating that issue, right? Than I would if he just told me about what the three body problem was. And, you know, it seems like whenever Zhi Jianlu is dealing with something that he's not super comfortable with, right, like socioeconomic politics, he just reverts into vomiting out, or like personal psychology. He just vomits out like, okay, these are the things that are occurring, right? These are the things that are happening. And he forces them into this like kind of, you know, I don't know, half-hearted, like the way he makes it interesting is by like changing the way in which it's expounded. So rather than just like write a chapter about this is what happened, he has, you know, Wei Jing be interrogated, right? He has her explaining it to Wang Mao, right? And it comes off like so, it just comes off so clunky.
Yeah.
Thanks for your contribution, Alex. We appreciate it.
I don't really have anything to add to that. I mean, you summed it up.
So, all right. So then let's... all right. So I want to talk about Zhi Jianlu a little bit here. Because I read... I sent the link to you guys. I don't know if you guys ended up reading his interview with The New Yorker. But he had a couple of interesting quotes here, which I will quote now. So in the interview, he says... The answer duplicated government propaganda so exactly that I couldn't help asking Liu, this is the interviewer talking, if he ever thought he might have been brainwashed. Liu says, I know what you were thinking, he told me with wary clarity. What about individual liberty and freedom of governance? He sighed as if exhausted by a debate going on in his head. But that's not what Chinese people care about. For ordinary folks, it's the cost of healthcare, real estate prices, their children's education, not democracy. And then he goes on to say, here's the truth. If you were to become the president of China tomorrow, you would find that you had no other choice than to do exactly as he has done. And so, you know, there's like a lot of speculation that I've read about Xi Jinping's politics. You know, it's like you can kind of do this about face with repressive regimes where you say like, oh, I'm just a writer, right? Like, don't bother me. And you actually are trying to send a message. But I think in Zhi Jianlu's case, he actually isn't trying to send any message. He is just creating fantastical worlds. And I think because science is kind of this like progressively creative activity that he can participate in, he evacuates all sense of politics. And like especially in the book, like the politics come off as so ham-fisted, right? Like this is not how political organizations are made, right? Or reinforced. The political struggles that happen in the ETO are they don't really reconcile with human psychology very well, and they don't really like even the government reaction to it is very, you know, it's too smooth. You know, there's like a little bit of bureaucratic mashup, but you have a competent commander, right? Like the right people are in the right places at the right time. You have the right material. Nothing really goes wrong when they try to, when they use that nanomaterial to fucking slice up the boat.
Yeah, there's no like diplomatic rift that they're doing this in international waters.
Right.
But NATO comes to China.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like the military leaders of the entire world are coming to China to coordinate the response. Like in this book, like China is either an equal to NATO, not just the United States, or in fact, like the dominant superpower of the world. Like that's the perspective of the book.
Ooh, that's a good one. I didn't pick that up when I was first reading it. You're right.
That may or may not be the case at this point. After we'll see how the next like 6 months play out, but this
right after the Chinese virus runs its course.
No, but I mean, like their response, like globally now, is interesting in that they're kind of, you know, obviously it originated in China, but they're also leading the push now in terms of distributing medical aid and medical expertise on this.
They've got a lot of propaganda makeup to do for the last year. Everything with Hong Kong and the Uyghurs, like they need to put on a PR campaign right now.
Yeah, and it seems like they're doing it. Like they're just, you know what I mean? Like they're distributing aid, like even into the EU at this point.
Right. Yeah, and they're having they're marshaling their industrial capacity to make the, you know, the protective equipment for healthcare workers and things like that.
Yeah, they may be demonstrating that their economic model is a little more practical.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
So let's see here. All right. So then another thing I want to talk about was like, so, you know, this book has had like an incredible resonance in China. I give a little bit less credence to how it's performed in the Western nations because like I feel like it was one of those books that like got a lot of sales because of the blurbs, you know?
Yeah, like, you get big people like Oprah and Obama to support it and all of a sudden millions of people read it.
Yeah, so I feel like it was kind of like a top-down influence, but I'm curious as to, do you guys have any thoughts about what social anxiety, or like what itch does Xu Xianlu scratch?
I mean, none.
That first contact there, I think, is like, that's always going to be something that we want to scratch. That's just like one of the very fundamental science fiction questions that like, you can never go wrong with that as your starting concept.
But it makes me wonder why like, better books that have dealt with that concept like don't get the same response.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the framing of it. So I think that his descriptions are very good, which is why the opening of this book was so good. But the dialogue is and characterization is pretty weak overall. But like it's just such a unique setting, especially for a Western audience. Like I've never read a novel set in the Cultural Revolution before that, I don't know. It's like just different enough where it's almost like all the trappings on the side are around the main story that's what draws you into it.
Yeah. I mean, if this book was set in Minnesota, no one would read it. The New York Times wouldn't talk about it. Or if they did, I don't know if they review books, but they would have given it a 1-star or something.
Yeah.
I think like there's an element of exoticism, is that a word?
Or yeah.
You know, orientalism?
That's the word. I think there's like an element of orientalism. How do you
orientalism? Like the orient, yeah, but thankism.
I think there's an element of that kind of comes into play. Like I think people like to be like, "Oh, I'm reading this, I don't know, this book, this Chinese book about like their perspective on it," when it's not a unique perspective. It's not unique to China, this perspective.
Right. So I'm trying to get at more the sense like I think the Western audience is like, you know, people who think that Barack Obama's opinion matters, and then also like scientists, right? So, like maybe grad students who are in the sciences, right? It might be an interesting book for them to read because they are actually the persecuted group in this case. right? As we know from Ted Kaczynski, they are in fact the perpetrators of all things that are wrong in this world, but they might perceive through this book that they are in the wrong, but or rather in the right as victims. But like, I'm more so asking about the what in China, right? Because this book became famous because it was famous in China. Like, any even just like vague speculations about, well, what made this book so exciting? Was it like the escapism of it, right? Because on one hand, right, it is kind of an escape, but it also deals with some pretty, it's not purely an escape. It's not pure fantasy or even like entirely speculative fiction. It does deal with the real world. So, you know, is there some salving effect that happens with this book? Is it bringing to the fore a question of, you know, where is China going? Is the technological progress of this nation, is it worth it? I know Troy, you talked about what were you talking about before I went on my rant?
I can jump in about like the early part of the book of the kind of not even the main story, but just the outside settings of it being set in the Cultural Revolution, and the perspectives of the Chinese characters, at least for a Western audience, is unique enough. I don't know. I thought it was, even though it does deal with heavy topics, I still thought it was a light read, just because, like, I don't know. It felt like escapism to me because it was fantastical. Like, when they cut apart the Canadian ship with a razor wire of nanomaterials, like, that stuff's not obviously not real, even though apparently that's what the aliens were most concerned about, was nanomaterials.
Because we could build a space elevator.
Right, yeah, because we built a space elevator, that's right.
Which is a real concept.
For sure.
Is conceptually real.
No, yeah, what we have to do is get something where we can, like, start producing things on the moon. That would exponentially shift what we can do in space if we could build things on the moon.
Totally. But, like, I think, like, the appeal to this book, I think there's just, like, an element of, like, PR or something that made it successful, and, you know, the exotic element of it being from China. But it does tap into existential anxieties about the end of the world, which is, like, obviously kind of, like, on the forefront of conversation with climate change. Obviously, this book is popular before the outbreak. But, like, you know, that's something that's pretty much on people's minds at all times. And that's, like, an existential threat to our existence as a species.
I also thought that one thing that it did do well, or that would draw people in, like, yes, the PR, yes, it being foreign for Western audiences. But, like, in terms of sci-fi, it did a decent job of just, like, throwing around a shit ton of jargon. And I, like, kind of followed it as a casual reader, but I was like, I have no idea what's going on. But they're, like, running back and forth, and it's like, oh my god, the radiology, like, this is an applied theory, this is too dangerous for you. And I was like, I have no idea what's going on, but, like, I'm just kind of following and enjoying the ride. So that's what it felt, that's why it felt like escapism to me, because it's like, it's kind of sciencey, but I'm also just like, you know, dude, you could say whatever right now. I'm not an astrophysicist, so, like, sure, just sure.
Right, but, I mean, most of the book takes place in today, right? So, like, I actually did not read this book as escapist really at all, except for the Trisolaris civilization and maybe the video game part of it. But even the video game part was trying to demonstrate a particular sociological problem, right, that is being dealt with. So, like I said, I'm really resistant to the idea that it's escapist. I actually do think it's, and it was popular in China before it was popular in the West. So, like, you know, I feel like it is tapping into maybe a sense of anxiety around, like, this hyper-technical, hyper-industrial China that's going forward and what the consequences of that might be.
Yeah, I mean, it represents China as, like, an extremely scientifically advanced culture where its scientists are being targeted for being top of the line. And, like, maybe that appeals. And I think China has, like, a culture where it really values, you know, their STEM workers. mm-hmm. for like obvious reasons. Like their society has industrialized extremely quickly because of like heavy investment in all of that, you know, like that sector of the economy and like development, which is mm-hmm. cool. But like, I think it may be also too, oh man, I lost my train of thought. I had two glasses of wine.
I've had like, I'm on like my fifth shot here, so we're good, dude.
Oh, but dude, I think one thing it taps into is like the persecution complex that academics have. And if you, and I think like Barack Obama is kind of like their kind of person's guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because like, I do think like in the United States at the moment, like liberal academics, they honestly have this like persecution complex where they do feel that they are victims. I mean, I think it applies more to liberal arts people than it does to like STEM people. And if I'm going to be honest, most of the STEM people I've known haven't been Americans, like at the college I went to. It's like, I mean, they have a partnership with a college in China. So it's like, there's a lot of Chinese people there. But so I don't know necessarily if they feel a persecution complex. I did not get the impression that they did. I think they were just like, oh yeah, I'm just doing this. I'm going to get a good job, you know?
Yeah, but I think it's interesting. It's an interesting intellectual exercise for those that do occupy those positions to have a persecution complex, right? Not that I'm not going to say his name because I don't know whether he wants me to share it or not, but this book was actually recommended to me by a friend who is a is in the hard sciences as a graduate student, and I'd be interested to hear what his perspective was because he can identify with the characters, right? Like I can identify with them insofar as they are human, right? But like he has their job, you know. He is working on, you know, on one of the many bleeding edges of technology, right? So like what would it mean to him, right, to have his experiments make no sense, right? To have, you know, to be persecuted from this like seemingly omniscient being. I don't know. And I think that would make the story more compelling from a personal standpoint rather than like a literary standpoint.
Sam, did you really connect with the characters though? I feel like I didn't connect that
much. I'm saying I did not connect with them, but I'm saying that a graduate student in the hard sciences would.
Mm. Really? Do you think it's enough just to share vocation?
In this particular case, yes, because we're talking about like the discovery, you know, like either practically or theoretically of you know, advances in human civilization, right? Like, you know, you think of something like nanomaterials, that's a cool concept to us, right? But like for somebody who is in practical applications of physics, right, like that's their whole career, right? You make a breakthrough in that thing, right? You could be you know, in the scientific community, extremely famous and very successful. Right. You know, there's a lot more meat to the, you know, what these scientists are doing and how something so fundamental as like, you know, science isn't real, right? Like obviously it would be psychologically damaging to us to find out the world was flat, but like, if a physicist discovered that the world was flat, I imagine they would kill themselves, right? Like, or many of them would, because their whole, you know, their whole motivation for existence is undermined by that fact. And so I think Xi Jin Liu is kind of going into this idea of like, well, how would you undermine a scientist's psychology? You would undermine their basic belief in what they're doing.
Yeah, I guess once you put it that way, I think about it, it is a really interesting concept. And I think the strength of this book is that there are so many interesting ideas that he has.
Yeah, just basing the whole thing on a three-body problem. Like, I had vaguely heard of it before, but like, I'm not into the hard sciences that much, so I haven't delved into it. But it's like, okay, yeah, this is a cool like concept that you could weave a story around. Like, I don't know. I enjoyed it. I thought there were a lot of good ideas, just with some poor execution.
I mean, I think that's good. I think that's a classic element of science fiction, in that an author is inventive and comes through with a lot of interesting ideas, interesting ways of framing a novel, but then fails to execute it. I mean, that's like the story of sci-fi.
it's truly unfortunate because I feel like these things could be done so well in a literary way, but like somehow, you know, the division of labor between those who are good at writing and those who know science is stark. I was saying that, like, I think that the best parts of this book were the Red Coast stuff. So anything to do with Wenji before she becomes like old and gives all her exposition, right, where she's at the center of the Cultural Revolution, she's out in the rural country, you know, discovering ecofascism or whatever, and then she eventually gets interned at Red Coast and then sends off the message. Those are the most powerful human moments. Those are the, you know, that's what would, despite Jijin Liu's either poorly translated or, like, you know, impossibly translated or poorly written, whatever it was, writing, that will shine through because it really connects you with this idea of, like, you know, I totally, you know, misanthropy is not something that's far away from me, right? Like, I definitely get tired of humanity at points. And I can definitely relate to the idea of, like, wanting to purge humanity of its ills. I think the Trisolaire's response is weak, right? But, like, her sending out the message is not. And especially in her circumstances of, like, resenting the results of the Cultural Revolution and, you know, having this very, like, private but unbending moral authority against humanity, it like, in a strange way, right, because of, I guess, you know, our conception of Chinese culture as collectivist, it does prioritize this individual act, right? Because if he doesn't send this message, none of this happens.
Yeah, I was very on board with Ye Wenji at the first half when she's, like, kind of taken to Red Coast. She doesn't want to be there, but she's grateful to be there. She marries the guy even though she doesn't love him, but it's like she owes him her life. And then when she just cuts them off the rope and murders the two guys, I was like, oh man, this is gonna get good. And then it just cuts to the future, like, 30 years later, and I was like, oh damn, like, it could have been so good if it had just stayed with her. I did love the scenes where she's, like, out in the countryside with the peasants discovering her eco-fascism. I agree, Sam. I thought those were some of the scenes that I could connect with the most. And also seeing, like, all the horrible stuff was a good way to build up to her sending off the message of just, like, screw it, purge us. I was like, hell yeah, Ye Wenji. Like, I'm with
Yeah, she was like an interesting character. I really wish that they did more than make her, like, a kind of weird double agent at the end. The author made her, her character was very dynamic and then became flat. I think he got distracted by the scientific problems he wanted to deal with. And, you know, I'm not really against, like, if you want to go into, you know, some sort of speculative sci-fi, that's fine, right? But you can't introduce this kind of wooden human element into it or, like, not finish the characterization you started. And like Alex said at the beginning, you know, if Da Shi is the best character in this book, that's not a recommendation of the characters of the book.
No. And it's I wish he had explored more that impulse in Yi to, like, destroy the, like, to be, like, willing to destroy the entire human race. Like, that's such a, like, a cool, powerful emotion, or, like, the psychology behind that is so fascinating.
Yeah, I thought there was going to be a lot more good psychology with her building the movement of, like, finding other not Chinese nihilists that just want to get rid of humanity entirely. Like, I thought that could have been explored really well psychologically, especially because, like, what does that say about a society that just wants to kill itself when you have first contact with another civilization and we're, like, so messed up, we're just trying to blow ourselves up. But right. Then it didn't really get that deep into it. It's just like she gave it to the Canadian and then the Canadian built the whole system kind of off screen.
And it's just like, how streamlined could it possibly fucking be? You know, like, she meets this Canadian who just happens to be the son of a fucking billionaire and can build these things, right? Like, there's no there's no material conflict with the world around them, and then there's no political conflict, right? There's it's just like, oh, we're all the ETO, and then there's like these vague sense of factions, but they're not like it's just described that this is what happened, not like there was any actual political conflict between the two, just that they were armed and that one side killed one another. I just, I understand maybe like limitations of words is part of the problem, because you have to do all this scientific exposition in order to like make your book sci-fi, but come on, right? Like, I feel like you just want to lean into one part or the other. And it's just unfortunate that he doesn't.
Yeah, I felt that was the most underdeveloped part. Like, the factions between the ETO could have been the coolest part of the book. Like, not whether we want aliens here or not. It's that everybody wants aliens here, but we are killing each other over what we want to do with them. Like, that could have been extremely cool factional politics and like people murdering each other, but instead it's just, I don't know, just the exposition, really. Like, they're all there when the police surround them, and then she sets off the grenade, and then they're just like with basically the whole crew tracking down the Canadian after that point. There's like no scenes really of the two factions fighting.
The nuclear bomb.
Wait, what? When is there a nuclear bomb?
When is there a nuclear bomb?
Don't they say that there's a nuclear bomb at the part when the police raid them?
Oh, yeah, that's right. But she has, like, it's not an actual nuke.
Tactical nuke.
It's just, like, so stupid. All right, fuck you. Like, I felt like I was watching, like, a made-for-TV action movie. Like,
yeah.
And, like, the part, like, and just even at the end when Wang somehow was, like, in a room with, like, NATO commanders. And it's, like, it reminded me of like a movie where like for some reason like Harrison Ford's just a normal guy, and then by the end of it he's like, or Will Smith is shaking hands with the president by the end of it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I definitely have that feeling.
Oh, it's like, oh, okay. I mean, it the whole thing, like the action elements of it, did feel like a bad Hollywood movie.
But that's just like, dude, the Chinese like that stuff. That's why Hollywood movies all suck ass now. All of our action movies and everything are pandering to Chinese audiences.
Dude, you're right. And I mean, if you look at like Chinese movies, like blockbuster Chinese movies too, it's like, I mean, there's like good ones, obviously, but there a lot of it is like extremely heavy-handed CGI action shit.
Catching up to the 90s, my dude.
What's that?
They're catching up to the 90s and the aughts.
I think that is a lot of why it is, yeah.
Oh, one movie that we should watch, what is it? It's like Red Tiger or something. It's about like Chinese special forces in Africa, and they have to protect these African villagers against like Western mercenaries, and it's like supposed to be the Chinese Rambo. I'm totally down to watch that. It's only with subs, but it seems pretty sweet. It's like Chinese nationalist film propaganda.
Oh, I'm super down. They make some fucking high action ass movies. You know what I mean? Like guns blazing, exciting stuff. Not necessarily like the best movie, but fun to watch.
It's good for the masses. Mm-hmm. All the sensationalism. Don't need to think too much about what's going on in the movies. You're right though, Alex. You picked out a lot of like little messages that the CCP was trying to send. I was like, huh. Yeah, I guess that is true. Or they're like slowly conveying that they're the superpower, that they're better, that they're equal or superior in so many different little ways.
It kind of makes sense if you're a Chinese person.
I mean, honestly, they're kind of, I'd say they're one of the top three civilizations of all time. Like their culture group has existed for 6,000 years.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty cool.
And I mean, they are economically becoming totally dominant.
No.
You don't believe that. You don't believe they're established.
Yeah, I do not think that they like economic dominance. Like they are a convenient deposit of low wage labor right now, and that will not be true forever.
You don't think that like the developing Chinese middle class is gonna. I don't know.
I think they will make demands on their own government, I think, eventually. But I don't think that it really has much to do with their standing in the world, because, I mean, not that the Chinese military is anything to fuck with, right? But, like, it would be such an intensely devastating experience for the CCP to go to war, right? And that's really what it requires, right? Like, our world is enforced by force. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's so many, like, currently, as it's configured, there are so many nations with economic interests in, you know, the Middle East and Africa and Asia, right? Like, the only way the Chinese make inroads in all of these different continents, you know, including South America, is through their economic leverage, which is predicated on American hegemony. There's no way around that.
Yeah, they need the dollar.
They need the dollar. They need the trade. You know, there's you know, we're mutually dependent in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah, we are lucky China's very inward looking. Like, they're not expansionist really at all.
I mean, they can't be right now. It would be devastating to the CCP. They'd lose their authority, right? They want a saber rattle from time to time, but there's no real, how could it, like, how could it manifest? You know, it would be the result of an insane ideologue, which is possible, but not likely. I mean, as far as, if Xi Jinping is in charge, right, he is like the ultimate, you know, I don't know, he's the Karen of the CCP. Like, he just, you know, he wants to be the manager. He wants to speak to the manager. Like, that's who he wants to be.
That mofo is the manager, dude.
Right. But he just wants to speak to the other managers of society and make sure that, you know, that the Chinese worker is not so, you know, destitute that they will, revolt or strike, and that, that I believe he was the one who instituted there was like a huge purge that happened in the CCP like a year ago or maybe a couple years ago.
Yeah, all their corruption trials.
Yep. So, you know, here we go. But I'm really, the whole idea of like, Chinese dominance over the current whatever geopolitical existence, I just don't buy it, because I don't see where the win is for the CCP
to become like the global superpower.
For what? It's expensive to be the global superpower. There's all this other kind of fucking responsibility that comes from that. You know, it's not just, in fact, it's like more, it's way more expensive for the CCP to suddenly become the, you know, the manager of the world, right?
Right, yeah.
I think that they will become, or it's almost not natural, but just their culture group is so large and so developed on its own that they almost like are going to, by default, be back at the top. Not that they'll be the ultimate hegemon of anything, since they're so inward looking. It's almost like there's so many people that they have to deal with their internal problems. They can't deal with external things, but it's like, you can't ignore them. There's 1.5 billion of them. They're extremely rich now. They're extremely powerful. I don't know. They're a weird, weird conglomeration of things. I don't ever think they'll be an expansionist power in the way that the US is.
No, but culturally they may become more influential. This might just be the start.
Yeah, Europeans are starting to learn Chinese.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's like, people got mad at Barbara Ehrenreich a lot for that tweet. I think we talked about it recently, where she said that Marie Kondo's show being subtitled on Netflix is an example of why how America's influence is waning globally. But I think like language and like what is like the most popular second language is like a good indicator.
Huge indicator, yeah.
It's a massive indicator.
They don't call it the lingua franca for nothing. Nobody fucking speaks French anymore, but they,
right.
You know, everybody used to speak French. And I mean, it was only through the convenience of the American Revolution that English transferred from the British to the Americans. But yeah, as you know, China is one of the most like learned languages in the world now, or Chinese rather. And, it, you know, it could eventually become dominant. And, you know, most people watch a ton of movies with English subtitles, or rather with their indigenous languages subtitles. So, you know, I could definitely see the Chinese influence increasing culturally. I very much don't see their dominance economically.
I feel like it's just going to run into problems of them internally. They still have 400 to 500 million people in poverty. Like, the middle class wants results. Like, they're pissed at the government way more frequently over economic stuff, over ecological things, over viruses. Like, it's going to cause so much strain for the CCP. The richer and richer they get, it'll be harder to maintain complete authoritarian rule.
Yeah, I mean, as long as the bread keeps coming, right? Like, there's not going to be too many complaints, but they're playing with fire, right? Like, you can't, you know, despite what the Stalinists might think, right? Like, you can't, they are just a more authoritarian version of the American government, right? Like, their whole goal is to intervene into these capitalist crises and then try to overcome them. And they might have more centralized authority to do so, but they're still dealing with them. And, you know, it's not like there aren't strikes in China, right? It's not like there isn't poverty in China. There's a ton of it. And they're constantly trying to thwart the ability for individual Chinese citizens to be inspired to revolt.
I don't think China's socialistic at all. Like, they're just a very centralized police state.
Yeah, I mean, that's my sense too. Yeah, pretty much.
Like, what do they do for their proletariat or for their middle class or for anybody that's not party cadres?
Well, I mean, they keep the money flowing, right? Like,
they're pragmatists. Like, I respect them for that.
There is support in China for the CCP, right? As long as things are going good, right? There's support. But they have to be like servants to the imperatives of the moment. They can't actually, they are conservative in the most like objective sense. They want to keep things the way they are in order to maintain their power structure.
Yeah, and they're incredibly conservative because they just have one large hegemon of a culture group and they just don't want to change it. They want to expand it or just keep it the way it is.
Right. You know what? This is my hot take for the evening. They are the representatives of neoliberalism. And they will die by that sword. I think we're pretty much done with book talk at this point, but like the scum of the earth who are just like, you know what? I wish we were more like China. That really grinds my gears.
You don't like that, huh?
No, I really don't. I really do. You know what? It is so servile to me to say that, you know, I wish we could respond like a regime that has total control over its society, like over civil society, right? That it can respond so effectively because its tentacles are everywhere. Right? It can do that, right? Whereas in America, we have, you know, things like federalism, we have states, you know, we have
liberties.
We have a bill of fucking rights that you can't just do whatever you want. And I'm not saying that, like, the COVID-19 crisis is not, you know, worth maybe temporary suspensions of things, right? Like, I would argue, you know, I would defend Abraham Lincoln for suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War, right? But hell, like, yeah. but it's insane to me that people are like, oh man, I really wish we had this government that could just do whatever it wanted whenever it wanted, right? That there was no stop measures between I decided something and it happened. I'm blown away by that because, I mean, to me, right, and I'm seeing this mostly from younger people, like, it basically means they have no value for just basic bourgeois right? The basic
rights infringed.
Right. They want it. They desire to have their rights infringed.
Maybe. They think they do. I don't know. If it actually happened, they might not be so happy.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't be happy, but, like, would they, like, I don't even know if they would revolt because it would be it would be they would just want to be oppressed by some other individual.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, just by each other. It is scary because, like, when the government takes action, whether it's necessary or not, to suspend rights or, you know, kind of extend their powers, like, it scares me to think, like, this, they maybe could not turn it back off afterwards. I don't know. That's something I'm worried about. I'll tell you what, I went to my local gun shop today, and they had pretty much completely of all defensive ammo. Pretty much all they had was 22, and they had sold out of pretty much every single gun in the store except for 22s, and they had pulled out a crate of Enfield rifles, like British rifles from World War II, and were just selling those in Mosins. Like, they had gotten through their entire inventory and were just selling, like, these dusty-ass ancient bolt-action rifles.
Wait, where are they selling Mosin Garands? Where is this?
They're selling at the store I go to in Barrington.
Barrington, okay.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if I want to plug the gun shop I go to, but yeah. But, like, the vibe is, at least in New Hampshire, it's like, dude, people are, and it's not young people our age, but people are uncomfortable.
Yeah, because they have some fucking respect for the idea of being free at all.
Dude, I'm uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable by it.
Oh, I'm very uncomfortable.
Yeah, but we're in the minority. We're in the minority of our age group.
But I also feel like I'm torn.
Daddy, government, please take care of me. Please, you know, restrict my ability to move. I'm unsafe, right?
I'm not an anarchist either, though.
No, I'm just saying, it's like, even anarchists, they are, you know, everybody is taught, like, anarchists, at least in my, like, from my perusal of people's opinions, their opinion is less of, like, we should, you know, push against the civil rights abuse, and more about, like, mutual aid in this situation, right? It's a complete ignoring of the state.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I understand, like, being scared, and, like, I think this is legitimately a scary situation. I think it'll end up being okay, I guess, but, like, I understand the impulse to, like, want to turn to somebody to make it better, and, like, I wish I could turn to the state and trust that it would make it better.
Well, I can understand why people would be desiring of a government that just gets something done, which is disgusting that it gets rid of rights, but if your government is so corrupt and so inept that it can't solve the problem, it's like, screw it, yeah, just give me something that works.
Yeah, I mean, our government has prioritized bailing out a lot of stupid fucking industries.
Airlines.
Not taking equity in them, which is the most insane aspect of this entire thing. If we're going to bail out the cruise industries, take over the fucking cruise ships, turn them into the hospitals.
They're not even American industries.
Nationalize the cruise industry.
I mean, to take the fucking boats. I don't know. Sink them. Do something with them. And I mean, the same with the fucking airlines. Like, the argument is that, oh yeah, Delta can do a better job than the state. Like, have you flown a fucking Delta Airlines flight? It's awful. If you say that, you're a fucking idiot.
I've never flown Spirit, but I've told it's really bad. It's super cheap.
Dude, they're all bad. All of them suck. Like, there's
Southwest is great. I love Southwest.
Southwest is okay. JetBlue is pretty good, actually.
I haven't flown JetBlue.
JetBlue, I flew to Austin and back. That was not a bad flight. But regardless, I think the government could do just as good of a job. I would be fine with slightly less of a good job. I don't, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
At least then the fucking money would go back to our government so we could buy bombs or something.
Yeah, exactly. So we can get some MOABs to bomb the Iraqis, right? We're gonna be. I'm like halfway through the book. Republic of Fear by Kanan Makiya, who is like a. I mean, he must have been a former leftist because he's quoting Lenin and Trotsky all the fucking time. But yeah, it's like, I think that's what colored my reading of this book, because the nature of Ba'athist Iraq was so, like, chilling. I mean, I was telling you, Alex, before, but, like, 1/5 of the Iraqi population in 1980, before the Iran-Iraq War, was involved in some sort of organized, like, was hired and employed by some sort of organized state violence force. right? So that is the equivalent of like if you met one out of every five people in America was employed by the CIA, the military, the NSA, right? Like some sort of organized state form of violence. And like, that's mind blowing to me. And it makes me very, it makes me so worried about people's reaction to all of this like government crackdown in the COVID-19 stuff. Cause like, are they going to take it back? Right? Is the government going to recede all of its overreaches, or is this just the new normal?
I don't know. They typically do not give it back. If we can look
at they'll keep as much as we don't notice.
Yeah, I mean, we'll just adjust. I mean, look how much we've adjusted to life since 9/11.
Hell yeah, dude!
Pretty dramatic changes and reductions in our civil rights.
Oh yeah,
in the scope of the government in terms of you know, I guess it would be a lie to say that like counterintelligence and like within the United States or like surveillance in the United States is increased. I don't know. I think they've always kind of been engaged in that, but like the legal ramifications for it, like versus like COINTELPRO or whatever that shit was called, like
COINTELPRO,
whatever. But you know what I mean? Like, so it's not that it always hasn't been around, but like the expansion of it and the kind of like normalization of it. And
yeah, the government, they repassed Patriot Act this year. They repassed all the mass surveillance stuff happened during the impeachment trial. They put aside all their
right now whether AOC voted for it or not.
They put down all their partisan differences to vote through espionage.
Bernie probably voted for it. I mean, honestly, this is the seeming response to this shit is in the primary thing is, I don't want to say radicalizing because I've never been a Democrat, but it's really made me hate them more than I already did, which is surprising.
I'm reading an article by Common Dreams that seems to imply that they voted for it.
Well, isn't Common Dreams like a Trotskyist website or something?
No, Common Dreams is a fucking, it's a George Soros website is what it is.
Oh, is it? Well,
no, nope, you know, we got no votes. Oh, okay. So Common Dreams is like a, yeah, so they voted no against the Patriot Act renewal at the very least.
Bernie and AOC.
Well, this is in the House, right? Okay. So Bernie's the senator. So yeah, the squad voted against it.
The squad. Right.
Ilhan Omar is the dopest out of all of them.
Who?
Ilhan Omar is the coolest out of all of them.
Yeah, whatever, dude. She wants to bang her brother or whatever the Republicans are saying.
Yeah, they are saying what? That. No, she. They're saying that she married her brother for immigration purposes. If so, I don't give a shit.
I mean, you know, dude, like, who am I to judge love? You know what I'm saying?
No, you can judge love.
No, you can't judge it. It's love, dude. It's love. Love is love.
Nah, I will reserve my right to judge whatever the fuck I want to judge.
Yeah, well, you can reserve your right and you can shove it up your ass.
Man, maybe Trump I will. Maybe I will.
Yeah. Well, Biden's going to take it away from you, and Trump's going to protect it, so you should vote for Trump.
Dude, just wait for the id poll struggle sessions, Alex, when they're hanging a sign around your neck which says love is love, and people are going to be beating you with belts.
Yeah, dude. When they go through my house and they find the bad boy books.
Yeah. And then, you know what they're going to do to humiliate you? They're going to try to make you deadlift 450 pounds. And they're going to be like, you can't do it, you fucking shrimp.
No, deadlifting will be problematic by then.
That's true. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, they're going to, like, strap you down and force feed you, like, estrogen pills.
Oh, man, I'm already doing that. I'm eating those impossible burgers, brother.
You're doing estrogen pills?
No, it's a joke about how they said Impossible Burgers are filled with estrogen.
Oh, that's hilarious.
That's what the...
Filled with bitch.
Yeah, what the Instagram racists are saying.
On a complete side note, did you guys see... You guys read that post about it's probably a fake post, but the landlord who was like, my 32 tenants are refusing to pay rent.
Yeah.
I've not seen that one.
It's pretty funny. I do like... The pushback that for some reason landlords are not expected to have like proper business savvy. Like every other business is supposed to have like fucking capital on hand, but the idea that landlords should is like unfathomable.
Yeah, I mean, a guy who owns 32 units, I'm really surprised that he doesn't have any money on hand. But like,
he's paying all that shit on mortgages.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess, you know, like I said, I mean, my uncle's, you know, has been a landlord in his life, and I love the fucking guy to death. Like, you know, I'd kill any Red Guard who went to assassinate him. But it's, you know, I mean, I definitely think that there's a very strange sense in which, you know, for landlords, they feel completely obligated to go to the bank and request some sort of deferral of mortgage. But for their tenants, they don't feel any mercy at all, which is
it's bizarre.
Really unfortunate. Yeah,
it's a must be a cultural thing, like an American thing.
Landlords are my least favorite group of people. Like,
I gotta say, I love my landlord. I actually got a message. Was like, yo, are you gonna pay rent this month? And it was like, yeah, 100%. I like my landlord. My landlord is
putting. Yeah, I love my landlord too. Yeah,
my landlord's putting up a couple in her house right now who has nowhere to go because they're getting quarantined. Like, my landlord's nice, and I guarantee you, if I said, yo, Sally, I can't swing rent this month, she would not break my balls about it. Like, I definitely get the problem with landlords structurally.
Yeah.
But, professional landlords. There's like people that have units. Landlords. Like, that's fine.
I mean, my landlord has a house, and she rents the basement and one of the cabins out. I think that's her sole income.
Right.
But
the thing is too is like month. You know, as my uncle said, right? Like the only way like a regular person, right, like who's not, you know, super smart and can't, you know, turn their labor into something that makes a lot of money, right? The only way they can make money is through real estate. Like that's the ticket right into the middle class.
Dude, it's totally fucking true.
Y'all gonna need read this book, Evicted. It's very good. It's about, as it sounds, evictions in Milwaukee, and it follows around some scummy landlords and some scummy tenants, but it's real good. It's a dark look at American cities, inner cities.
Sounds cool. Well,
sounds cool, yeah.
Cool.
Some good sociology stuff. Not for this group, but y'all should read on the side.
Sure.
We can read landlord fiction or landlord nonfiction.
We can read whatever we want.
I'm starting a side little group. I'm going to read the Bible cover to cover because I've never done it. So me and a couple friends are going to every day, just couple chapters every day.
That's cool.
Damn, dude. That's fucking dope.
Mad respect to that.
In the beginning, there was the Word, and the Word was God.
Yeah.
Nice.
How much are we reading of what's that book called? The Cuban one. That's right.
The whole thing? I don't know.
Planet for Rent.
I don't want to read the whole thing for next time because I'd like it to actually happen.
You don't think we could read the whole thing in a week?
Let's see how long it is.
I would be surprised. I mean, I'm pretty I'm not like swamped with work, but. I definitely am like under the gun right now, so
that's okay.
I prefer not to have to read the whole thing.
It's 272 pages.
So
is there a halfway point?
You know, it's pretty small print too, so I think yeah, halfway would be solid. There's a chapter at page 154.
154 it is, baby.
Yeah, it's the majority shareholder is the name.
Puts us at a little over halfway. Man, yeah, I've been trying to read, and I've been feeling I had a good run at the beginning of this emergency, but I have been so stressed out, I haven't really been able to concentrate since then.
Yeah, dude, it blows. There's so many things that I want to do, but like my back is just fatiguing the shit out of me. So it's like I've done almost nothing, which it's like I have all this time on my hands now, but nope.
I'm with you. I haven't even played video games or anything. I don't even know where my days are going. It's the dread. Cuts into reading time.
Dude, you gotta read about the Iraqi bath party. I'm telling you, that'll light you right up.
Dude, just watch The House of Saddam. The House of Saddam on HBO is very good.
House of Saddam? I gotta watch that.
I don't want any of that in my life right now.
Why not, dude? Saddam Hussein was very interesting.
Yeah, true. I'm trying to just feel better.
Yeah, but there's nothing that makes you feel better than a murderous dictator.
Dude, yeah, sometimes you just need a good feel-bad book. Like, when I broke up with Megan, I read some books about Nazis. Like, You just gotta read some feel bad. It makes you feel better.
I should just start The Hobbit again is what I really should be doing.
That's what you should do, yes.
Or read Hemingway. Hemingway always makes me feel better.
Why does Hemingway make you feel better?
Because all the characters are drunks.
No, but it's simple, and it's men versus nature, men versus fashion. You know what I mean? It's not...
Yeah.
It's not... It's complex emotionally at times, but it's not very... You know what I mean? And it's comforting. Right. The morals of the stories are comforting.
I feel that.
You know, you're not dealing with some deep, brooding, existential bullshit. Like, I wouldn't want to read Celine right now.
No, dude. Nah. Nobody wants to read Celine ever.
Yeah. I'm reading another Welbeck book right now, and it's pretty good, but, like, it's good because it's, like, got this weird, like, drunken, horny irreverence to it, which Celine can't really pull off.
No. He's, like, horny, but in, like, a depraved sense.
Yeah. So, like, the navel-gazing is not as enjoyable to read.
I've been recommended from a friend the Neil Strauss book, The Pickup Artist Guy. It's honestly just kind of sad. Like, I'm reading through it, and it's, like, all these different ways to pick up women. It's like, oh. It's like, you could just talk to them. It's like all these weird, kind of creepy ways of tricking them into conversation with you.
Oh, that stuff is fucking insane. I wonder if it works. I doubt it.
No, I've had multiple people have told me it works. And also, like, I've seen men be assholes to women and it works, which is very sad. But
I've never hit on a woman.
No?
I don't think I ever have, no.
No, you're a nice guy. And, like, that is a play, too. It's not like it's the only effective strategy. It's just the optimal one.
Right, but I've never, like, gone to a bar and, like, picked up a woman. Never really wanted to. I like to stay inside.
Yeah. You're a hermit.
Yeah, especially these days.
Yeah, dude, you're Sutri. You're just drinking down by the river.
Pretty much. If Sutri had the Criterion Collection and a cat, I mean...
Dude, yeah, I gotta get on the Criterion Collection since my friend shared it with me. There's some good stuff on there.
Next week they're adding a playlist of noir movies.
Oh, nice.
It looked like so many good movies. I'm pretty amped.
Dude, watch 8 and a half. 8 and a half is so good.
8 and a half, okay. I'll put it on
It's Fellini.
Oh, okay. I've just started working on watching his movies, and Knights of Cabria I watched the other night. So good.
I haven't seen that one. I've only seen La Dolce Vita and 8 and a half, both of which are very good.
Yeah, I'm trying to watch a movie a day. Easy.
Solid goal. Good goal.
Yeah, it's been fun.
A movie a day keeps coronavirus away.
I hope I didn't catch it today.
Why? Where'd you go?
I went to the gun store for like 2 minutes.
Oh, the gun store, yeah.
In the grocery.
Did you wash your hands?
Yeah, and I didn't like get close to anybody. I'm sure I didn't. I'm just being anxious. I don't really think washing your hands does anything, does it?
Yeah, it does. It kills it. Antibacterial soap kills it.
Yeah, but you catch the virus through inhaling, you know, droplets.
Yeah, so if you touch your face with your dirty hands, then you get it.
But you can. It also, like, people cough on surfaces and it settles onto surfaces. So if you touch it,
it can be floating in the air too, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like it's not going to be unless someone's coughing directly in your face. It's not going to float into your mouth.
True.
Yeah,
true.
I think you're more likely to get it by touching something unless somebody is like, yeah, directly around you putting it in the air.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's fine. Even if I get it, I mean, I'll be fine. It's just anxiety.
All right, fam, I'm going to wrap it up. We can keep talking, but
this is going to suck dick to edit.
Yeah, fuck you, dude. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Next week, we are going to read A Planet for Rent by Yoss, is what the internet is telling me right now. And we are going to be reading half the book to page 154, if I remember correctly. Mm. And if you'd like to leave a voicemail on our Book Nerd Hotline, we already have a few lined up from Christopher DiLoretto, who is a favored guest of this podcast. But you can also call in with your complaints, tirades, corrections, bitching, whatever you'd like to do at 1-978-255-3404. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a good night.
Night, everyone. Bye.